Measures cannot be imposed on the people without their assent through Parliament. During the Wars of the Roses, this idea was brilliantly articulated by Sir John Fortescue. He argued that England was more prosperous than France because France was governed by a dominium regale, in which the French king had the power simply to take the produce of the poor French farmers. By contrast, if the King of England were to attempt a similar manoeuvre against an English farmer, the English farmer would have recourse to the courts, including the High Court of Parliament. As Sir John explained, the English king is under the law, just like everyone else, and must, as he puts it in his commendation of the laws of England, take away none of his subjects' goods without due satisfaction for the same. He continues, neither does the king there, either by himself or by his servants and officers, levy upon his subjects talliages, subsidies, or any other burdens, or alter their laws, or make new laws, without the expressed consent and agreement of his whole realm in Parliament. Wherefore, every inhabitant of that realm bless and enjoyeth at his pleasure all the fruits that his land or cattle beareth, with all the profits and commodities which by his own travail or by the labour of others be gaineth by land, by water, not hindered by the injury or wrong detainment of any man, but that he shall be allowed a reasonable recompense. England, he concluded, is governed by a dominium politicum et regale.
Well, I think all sensible people have the British Constitution as one of their hobbies. It is the most interesting matter to discuss and be informed about. As Dicey said, Dicey argued, it is Parliament that is the defender of the liberties of the people, of our ancient constitution and of our freedoms. I give way. Welcome to this next edition of the podcast on how Parliament works. I'm here today with Dr. Hannes Kleinecker, who is an expert in the medieval Parliament, and I'm hoping to talk to him about Sir John Fortescue, because I think Fortescue's influence and insights are very important, but they were of course based on what Parliament was like in the 15th century, very much the area of expertise of Dr. Kleinecker. So if we could start, my first question. One of the things that really interests me about Sir John Fortescue is that he writes about the king being under the law, but he's doing this during the period of civil war, during the Wars of the Roses. So to what extent was the king under the law during the Wars of the Roses, and how were the 15th century parliaments operating?
Well, I think one of the basic problems that we have is that Fortescue grew up in the reign of Henry VI, and there's obviously quite a lot of debate about Henry VI and his kingship. Was there even a king? I mean, for the first 15 odd years of his reign, Henry is a baby, so there's clearly no royal agency whatsoever. The crown, as we might understand it, is essentially represented by what we would nowadays regard as the Privy Council. So there is a crown, there is not necessarily the person of the king. Subsequently, we have a few years when Henry does appear to play an active part in policy, but of course he loses his mental and physical capacity in 1453 for the last 8 years of the reign. Again, the king is, if anything, a shadow. The really interesting thing about Fortescue's position in all of this is that a lot of what he writes is really only developed at the point when there is once again an active king in the person of Edward IV. And of course, his governance of England is essentially something that he cobbles together in order to curry favour with this new and more vigorous monarch.
Yes, and yet this new and more vigorous monarch is vigorous and is ruling. And how constrained was he by parliaments? Because I know this is very much an area of your expertise, the parliaments of the Yorkist kings. So to what extent was Edward IV interested in parliament, or perhaps not interested, as bound to engage with parliament?
Well, I think the best you can say about Edward IV in that respect, and don't get me wrong, I think he's a great chap, would have been fantastic to have a pint with in the pub or whatever after a rugby game, but he is certainly not somebody who holds much truck with Parliament. He's very much somebody who treats them at the Lords and Commons at very best with polite disregard, if not with downright rudeness. Time and time again, Parliament is prorogued, and as soon as the Lords and Commons turn back up at Westminster or sometimes at York or Reading, they're essentially met by a government minister who tells them, awfully sorry, the King's a little bit busy at the moment, could you come back in 3 months' time? So that's one part of it. The second part, and this curiously is something that really develops in the period after the governance of England has been written, one of the great powers to this day of Parliament is, of course, the control of the purse strings. And this is essentially something, having just been lectured, if indeed he read it, by Fortescue, you know, on the need to refer to Parliament for fundraising, that Edward IV writes across roughshod. It's the only way of putting it. He develops a new taxation device known as the benevolence, which is a prerogative tax. In other words, it is something that the king just levies. He levies it courteously, as in there are very polite requests sent to people, but refusal isn't really an option.
So Fortescue is writing about this idealised monarchy of England that doesn't really exist in his lifetime.
Absolutely. And if it ever existed, and the Lancastrian kings, or Henry VI's council, as I've just explained, do have to go back to Parliament for cash time and time again. The Lancastrian Parliament, again, is a curious creature, because far from being sort of, you know, this paragon of democracy or proto-democracy, as which it's sometimes been regarded, it's invented the magic money tree, is the only way of putting it. Taxation in the Lancastrian period is granted very, very occasionally, very sparingly, and the grants they make are often spread over a period of years. Instead, what Parliament authorises is borrowing on an industrial scale, all of which is to be secured by future grants of money. Now, this situation, and let's not forget that Fortescue is a parliamentarian for sort of the first 30-odd years of his life. But subsequently, when he becomes Chief Justice, he very much becomes a servant of the Crown. So his thing is that he sees that the King hasn't got enough money, and that clearly plays a part in him developing this idealised way of how Crown and Parliament should interact.
And from that, his theory that the prosperity of England comes about because of the correct relationship between the Crown and the country at large. And therefore, I assume if the relationship isn't right, the prosperity won't be there and therefore the funds won't be there. So it becomes an argument created because of the difficulties he's finding in seeing the Crown have sufficient funds.
I think that's very much the way I would read it. The prosperity of the country is something that's in his earliest writings, the stuff that he does write under Henry VI, which is badly written, very, you know, very business-like stuff, but not as eloquent as his later materials.
And how much was he a figure of his time? Were people listening to him? Were they interested in his ideas? Because the first printing of one of his works is in the early 18th century, so he gets completely forgotten for a few hundred years.
Absolutely. He's very much a voice crying in the wilderness, is perhaps the wrong expression, because that brings up images of St. John the Baptist as the sort of precursor of Christ. He's a voice, but he's an unheard voice, in essence. The bulk of this stuff that he writes in exile. This is a desperate man. This is a man who's had very high office of state, and overnight he's out of a job, overnight he's in exile, and he's saddled with, you know, for the Lord Chief Justice of England, the surely unpalatable task of homeschooling probably the most obnoxious teenager, you know, that the English royal family's ever seen. I'm sure there's a few to choose from, but Edward of Lancaster's up there.
So I know about his writings, but I know much less about Fortescue's life. Why does he have to go into exile? What leads to this?
It's ultimately his loyalty to Henry VI and his dynasty. He's had a fairly standard, if meteoric, legal career, taking him up to the office of Chief Justice. And already by 1450, when we have Jack Cade's rebellion, so an actual uprising for the first time against Henry VI and his ministers, even at this point, he's marked out as one of the court clique. And it is said by one observer that he was actually sitting at home waiting, you know, to be attacked. So by this point, he is very much an associate with the crown. He's very much a minister of the crown. Sorry, I've slightly lost the track of your question.
Was on why he had to go into exile.
Yes, that's right. So he's very much a figure of the court, and he remains part of the court circle, the court party, throughout the 1450s. So he's still there as Chief Justice, and presumably, you know, builds up a relationship with the Queen at as early a stage as the King's incapacity between, give or take, 1453-4, with another relapse in 1455. And in 1455, we have what's probably one of the key events of the man's life. We have one of the first armed engagements of what we might know as the Wars of the Roses, the First Battle of St. Albans. And on this occasion at St. Albans, his brother Richard is killed. And that really is, it's a sea change. That sort of is the point, I think, when Fortescue goes Lancastrian, well, even more Lancastrian than he possibly has been before. The 5 years that follow are unhappy ones in English history, as I think is relatively widely known. This is the bit when the country really descends into a civil war. And by 1458, 1459, we really have two entrenched factions. We have on the one hand the Lords supporting Richard, Duke of York, Henry VI's near relative and potential heir. And on the other hand, we have the court party very much headed by the Queen, Margaret of Anjou, French-born queen, who by this stage is reasonably secure because, of course, 5 years earlier, she has finally had a son and heir. And now the two parties really clash. There are armed clashes from which I probably don't need to give you the blow-by-blow account of it all here. But from all of this, the Yorkists, by 1460, emerge victorious. Under the auspices of Richard, Duke of York, a government is set up and Parliament agrees that Henry VI is to remain king for life and on his death to be succeeded by the Duke of York. We then fast forward to Christmas of that year, Christmas 1460. The Duke of York has decided to keep Christmas in the north, where there are still strong pockets and entire armies of Lancastrian loyalists. And the Duke of York is killed in an engagement on the 30th or 31st of December 1460. His son and heir, the future Edward IV at this point, is keeping Christmas in Shrewsbury, so it takes some time for the news to get down there. While a fresh army is being raised in the marches in support of the Yorkist cause, the northern army that has just killed the Duke of York, led by Queen Margaret, marches on London. Fast forward a little bit further, we have a second battle at St. Albans on the 17th of February, 1461. And on this occasion, Henry VI, who's previously been in the custody of the Yorkist lords in London, is recovered, if you want to use that expression, by the Queen. So the Queen has the king, the Yorkists don't have a king through whom they can rule anymore. So they do the obvious thing, they proclaim the young Duke of York, the late Edward IV, king. At this point, we have a new king, we have two kings. Queen Margaret and her army, now in the company of Henry VI, withdraw north. In the spring of 1460, there is a decisive battle at Towton in Yorkshire, as a result of which the Queen, the King and the Prince have to flee into Scotland. And that is, give or take, where they end up remaining. Henry VI ultimately returns to England, is eventually captured in 1465 and placed in the Tower. The Queen and Prince, with Fortescue on their coattails, eventually depart to France, where they're put up in a place called Coeur, in the Duchy of Bar in the Lorraine region. And there her father, René of Anjou, sets them up with the court in exile. So Fortescue starts off by teaching this prince first in Scotland and then subsequently in France, from where he's occasionally dispatched to England by the Queen.
Okay, so he's in exile because of the of Towton, the disaster of Towton for the Lancastrian cause and the need for them to flee into exile, and he's there as tutor to the Prince of Wales, who, as you were saying, was a particularly difficult teenager to be the tutor to, and he's trying to inculcate in him how you should be the perfect monarch, understanding the Dominum Politicum et Regale, which is his sort of central point. So in a way, he's not entirely dissimilar from Machiavelli, is he? That he's trying to teach a prince how to behave whilst being an active political figure for whom things are going quite wrong at various times.
Yes, effectively. I mean, the main difference is that the prince whom Machiavelli had to advise was probably, you know, an easier character to work with, I would have thought. I mean, his initial didactic text is cast in the form of a dialogue between him and the prince. And I'm always struck that that actually starts by him telling the boy that it's all very good, you know, to be good at martial arts and stuff, but as a king you need a little bit more. We're going to have to get our head round the common law. And I think you can actually see the prince's reactions through some of what Fortescue writes.
Oh, that's so interesting. I have read it, but I hadn't realised that subtlety of it. I'd read it more as a formalised conversation rather than thinking, gosh, there is this teenager being told, come on, stop mucking about with arms and armour. We need you to sit down and understand the common law. And the teenager thinking, oh, heaven's sake, now I'd much rather be out hunting or something.
Yeah, and there's in this initial exchange, there's even the suggestion that wouldn't it be, you know, far better to study divine law, which again is a very interesting thing to write into words that you put in the mouth of someone who is, after all, going to be a ruler by divine right, or so he thinks.
Or so he thinks, and then, of course, he's killed.
Yes.
And it's the Battle of Tewkesbury that he's killed.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. And so what happens to Fortescue then?
Well, Fortescue is in that unfortunate group, a bit like the Queen and the Prince, who've literally left it at the very last minute to come back to England. They all sat out in France right into April 1471, so the Battle of Barnet has already been fought and lost by the time that they actually arrive in England. He literally has these few days, probably in the company of the Queen, and that's it. He is then essentially, you know, arrested and has to try and find a way of ingratiating himself, I suppose, with the man whose title to rule he's been disputing for the last 10 years and in writing.
Okay, and does he succeed in that? What, or does he come to a sticky end?
He does succeed in that, and that again is one of the interesting things. If you look at the royal household accounts, it happens rather a lot sooner than is generally assumed. So one of the interesting things about the relationship, if any, between Fortescue and Edward IV is that Edward clearly has singled him out as somebody to keep an eye on. Now, whether this is just the case because he wants him bumped off or wants him locked up or whatever is anybody's guess, but the next thing that Fortescue then writes, the governance of England, is directed, or so we believe, at Edward IV. I mean, again, we have the problem that the manuscripts are damaged or lost, such as they were, and that we have to work from later editions to know whether there was, in fact, this dedication to Edward IV. But all the indicators seem to be that he'd smelt the coffee and dedicated this last work to the man who was then undeniably on the throne.
Even if the man who was on the throne wasn't necessarily very sympathetic to the idea that there were any limitations to his power, least of all Parliament.
Absolutely. There's no chance whatsoever that Edward IV ever read the thing. I very much doubt he ever read anything, quite frankly.
So, I suppose one of the interesting questions is, why do kings keep on coming back to Parliament? Because there are times when they can't govern without Parliament, they need money, there's a weak monarchy, etc., etc. Parliament's obvious. But there are times when you have the really strong kings like Edward IV, and I mean Henry VII, who succeeds him with a brief gap, or at the end of the Wars of the Roses, again, is a very strong king. How does Parliament keep on surviving in these circumstances? Why aren't we like France, where you basically have Parliament ignored, or the Estates General ignored, for centuries at a time?
Well, I think there are two factors in play here. The first one is an inherent conservatism and a concept of kingship. In order to be a good king, you're very much expected to do the sort of things that a good king would do. And by the 15th century, Parliament is very much part of the national, I use that word sort of tentatively here, the national fabric. In other words, Parliament is part of the political structures within which a king is expected to rule. You don't have to summon it, and that's very much what Edward IV and his successors do. They do without Parliament for years at a time. Parliament is very much only summoned when the king wants money. But when you have a Parliament, then you've got to go through the motions and somehow work with it. You have to offer the community of the realm redress of grievances, etc., etc., etc. That's just the way it is. And of course, if you want to go to war, the sort of sums of money you need are such that you can't get away without doing it, you know, through Parliament.
So the benevolence simply isn't enough.
The benevolence isn't enough, nor is the pension with which the French king buys off Edward IV in 1475. So he has got this added cash flow coming from France every year, which essentially allows him this degree of independence from Parliament and to rule just with the occasional benevolence where required. 1483, all of this has dried up. So in the last, what ended up being the last year of Edward IV's life, the stream of cash from France has dried up, so this is when he has to turn back to Parliament in order to fund warfare against the Scots.
It's very interesting how many similarities there are in different centuries. That, I mean, if you fast forward to Charles II, he's getting a subsidy from the King of France. He doesn't call Parliament. He lives off prerogative revenues. As I've been doing this How Parliament Works series of podcasts, again and again one sees the repetitive nature of history and the sort of luck, in a way, that events come together so that Parliament has to be recalled, and it never goes too long without it being needed, and therefore, as you put it, it remains a part of the formal nature of kingship. Rather like the garter ceremony, that kings have to have a garter ceremony, and they just carry on with it because it's expected. They have to have a parliament every so often, and they carry on with it because it's expected. And gradually, the realities of power shift around the structures that happen to exist.
Yes, I think that's a very good way of putting it.
Well, thank you. Now, one of the things I've got to ask you about, it's slightly self-indulgent of me, is that I see that you are an expert in the representatives called to Parliament from various counties, including Somerset. Now, I'm completely obsessed by my own county, being a representative called from Somerset, so I just wondered if you could tell me a little bit about the work you've done on the members from Somerset.
Sure, not a problem. I mean, Somerset, curiously enough, is sort of, it's where I went when I'd finished Cornwall and Devon. So much of my research has indeed been focused down in the southwest. Somerset is one of these counties that used to form part of the ancient demesne of the kings of Wessex and then subsequently England. So this is very much the heart of the old Anglo-Saxon state. And as a result, all those former bits of the royal demesne ended up having rather a lot of parliamentary boroughs. So quite apart from the two knights of the shire that Somerset sends to Parliament, there are members for the cathedral cities of Bath and Wells, for Taunton, yet another bishop's borough at that part in the Middle Ages owned by the bishops of Winchester, and then Bridgewater. Now, Bridgewater is another curious one. We sort of think about Bridgewater nowadays as a largely landlocked place. As it happens, it's actually deemed a port in those days, and it's the head port for the customs collection in in the Somerset region, sort of just up the coast from Barnstaple. So a lot of trade going on there. And that's ultimately something which is also reflected in the parliamentary representation of these places. For much of the 15th century, successive bishops of Bath and Wells tend to serve as Lord Chancellor of England. So they have a sort of vested interest as one of the senior members of government in having their servants in the Commons and representing, if you like, their interests or supporting their interests as and when this is required. This becomes probably more pronounced, I would have said, from the Yorkist period onwards, but we see it previously under Bishop Stillington, Edward IV's Chancellor for many years, and before that, Thomas Beckington, who'd been Henry VI's secretary. These servants, bishop's servants, tend to be placed in either Bath or Wells. Now, Somerset in the period is also a centre of cloth manufacture, as indeed it remains for some centuries afterwards. And as a result, there's an awful lot of wealth in the county. And that, of course, gives the larger merchants of places like Taunton or Wells enough self-confidence, I suppose, to want to have their own interests represented in the Commons. A lot of taxation in the period is obviously imposed on trade in the form of various customs subsidies or whatever on goods leaving the country. And the wealth of England lies not merely in raw wool, it increasingly lies in manufactured and finished cloth. So you get all these cloth merchants being sent by the towns of the southwest into Parliament, essentially to argue against the imposition of customs subsidies and other levies on their goods.
Oh, how interesting. And because of the history of Wessex and King Alfred and so on and so forth, you've got additional representation in Somerset which facilitates this. And you've got the bishop's interest, and of course you've got Glastonbury Abbey, which is one of the richest abbeys in the country, at the centre of Somerset political life.
Well, this is another aspect of pre-Reformation history that we sometimes lose sight on, because we get so fascinated, you know, by everything we can find out about these often largely unknown members of the Commons. We do sometimes lose sight of the fact that in the House of Lords, the vast majority of members are not just bishops, but indeed abbots. And Glastonbury is, yes, it's the richest abbey in England, but it's really just one example of the multiple great houses that are, again, for the same reason, concentrated in ancient Wessex. These are the early foundations, the Anglo-Saxon foundations, which still send their abbots to the lords in the 15th century.
Indeed, and the blessed Richard Whiting, who is killed off by Henry VIII, is an abbot who comes to the House of Lords, I think, just the year before Henry VIII kills him. And so, yes, the abbots of Glastonbury remain key figures until the Reformation has their abbey dissolved. Well, this is absolutely fascinating. I could talk about Somerset all afternoon, but this fits in with my general rather Whiggish view of Somerset being the centre of everything and all good things originate in Somerset. So I'm very grateful for this part of the conversation, but also to you for joining me today and sharing your expertise on Sir John Fortescue and a very interesting period of parliamentary development, where I think the summary is that we were very lucky that Parliament survived kings like Edward IV.
I think that's probably a good way of putting it, indeed, yeah. I'm sorry if, you know, what I've had to say about Fortescue's writings doesn't necessarily fit in with the general gist of the series of podcasts, but, you know, you can't win them all.
It fits in perfectly because it's an attempt to understand more and to see the fuller picture and to understand that very often what people write about saying this is how it is actually means this is how I would like it to be.
I think in sort of in line with what you were saying a moment ago about, you know, finding the same phenomena in different periods. One thing that has always fascinated me about the medieval parliament, and one of my great interests, probably dovetails with one of yours, it's parliamentary procedure. And one of the things that really interests me about parliament is just how much of present-day parliamentary procedure Fortescue would have found familiar.
Well, that's fascinating. I was very interested when we were setting up a petitions committee on the early development of petitions and how they evolved into legislation. And the means of seeking redress of grievance used by members today is not dissimilar to our forebears. And like you, I find these continuities absolutely fascinating.
Any day. I can talk about parliamentary procedure all day long.